from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
This is the suspect that everyone has been looking for, public enemy number one here in New York and New Jersey. This is Ramani after being allegedly shot by police officers in a shootout here in Linden not too long ago.
The son of the Republican presidential candidate uses some poorly punctuated language, comparing Syrian refugees to poisoned Skittles.
Police video shows the moments before 40-year-old Terrence Crutcher is shot and killed by a Tulsa police officer.
So you haven't resigned, you haven't returned a single nickel of your personal earnings, you haven't fired a single senior executive. Instead, evidently, your definition of accountable is to push the blame to your low-level employees who don't have the money for a fancy PR firm to defend themselves.
That's some of the week's news, a bit out of context. John Dankosky here on The Wheelhouse with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hello there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Susan Bigelow is here. She's a contributing columnist at CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello there, Susan.
Good morning.
And Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst. Hello, Bill.
Morning, sir.
It has been kind of a crazy week in the news, and if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Police have arrested a suspect, Ahmad Khan Rahami, in connection with this explosion that happened last Saturday in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan. 29 people were wounded. Thankfully, there are no casualties. We're going to ask a few questions about what the terrorist act, the potentially terrorist act, means between now and November. Let's listen to a little bit of how the presidential candidates talked about this during and after the event.
I must tell you that just before I got off the plane, a bomb went off in New York, and nobody knows exactly what's going on. But boy, we are living in a time. We better get very tough, folks. We better get very, very tough. Just happened.
This threat is real, but so is our resolve. Americans will not cower. We will prevail. We will defend our country, and we will defeat the evil, twisted ideology of the terrorists.
Of course, Colin, a lot of what we do on this program is look at the news through the lens of politics. But let's just talk about the news and maybe give me your impression of what we saw in New York, the reaction of America to this news that we had these seemingly homemade improvised explosive devices, one of which went off. A few others were found in Manhattan and in New Jersey.
Right. So if you have to be a terrorist, it's good if you suck at it. Fortunately, Rahami appears to have been kind of a bumbler. I mean, this really was a really big bomb, though, and it really could have hurt a lot of people. And New Yorkers are kind of amazing in the way that they sort of, you know, push back and stuff like that and kind of get themselves back up on their pins probably faster than certainly any city in the United States and probably faster than most cities in the West anyway. So I guess what I would say about this, though, I mean, first of all, yes, terrorism is what it is, and these acts need to be looked at for exactly what they are before they're filtered through the lens of politics. One thing I would quickly say about those clips, though, is they're very far apart in time, right? So you're hearing Donald Trump. He's fresh off the plane. He's in Colorado, I believe, and he's talking about – he's just heard about a bombing. He got some criticism for calling that a bombing before anybody knew it was a bombing. I'm not really sure that criticism will stick to him very much. Then you're hearing Clinton quite a ways later when she's had a chance to compose herself and compose her remarks. So there isn't really a precise equivalency to those clips. One thing that I would say that I am trying to make a practice of doing is listening to podcasts that have different points of view. So on Monday night, I was driving down to tape a different podcast. This is what's wrong with my life right now, but to tape a different podcast. And I was listening to Ben Shapiro, who runs one of the more prominent, maybe the most listen to conservative podcast. I'm not sure. You know, and he had an interesting frame for this, which was that Trump ultimately in his first 20 – he doesn't like Trump, but he said, you know, in those first 24 hours, Trump at least to his base, to the kind of people who are persuaded by him, could make people feel safe or like he could make me – or make them feel like they could be safer, you know? I mean, it's a lot of bluster. It's a lot of rhetoric. It doesn't seem to have anything behind it. It's just a lot of kicking ass and taking names. But for a certain percentage of the American public, that actually is going to resound, you know, in a fairly effective way. Clinton, in her first 24 hours, you know, she had a lot of very measured stuff to say, stuff that was very responsible, very Secretary of State-like. And there is a certain set of ears for that, too, right? People want a grown-up in charge when there's chaos. But I wouldn't mind if Clinton in the first 24 hours had something really punchy to say. Not punchy like we're going to go punch terrorists, but punchy like this is something that you can remember that I said about this. And it's something that I think she needs to do better. Have something to say where you go, oh, yeah, if she was president, that's what she'd do.
Well, I don't think it's going to move the needle much, though, on whether or not on what the polls say, et cetera. I think that people are going to see terrorism. They're going to see these particular actions through whatever frame they're going to see the world through, and that frame ultimately dictates who you're going to vote for as well. So certainly there's going to be people who are afraid, who want the kind of reassurance that Colin's talking about, and they're already with Trump. For the most part, they want to go. They want to see that sort of strong, kicking butt and taking names response. Whereas the more measured responses, I think most of them are already going to go for Hillary Clinton, and I don't think that it's really going to change much. I don't think that we're going to see any kind of massive, any kind of attack on these smaller scales or larger scales that's really going to move the needle much in the presidential race, because people have already decided what their frame is going to be.
Clinton, throughout the course of the last couple of days, stresses resolve. Trump talks about getting tough. Bill, not terribly different from what we've heard before. The fact is that this is an act. If bumbled, as Colin said, it does indeed shake us a bit and wake us to the notion that these sorts of things can and will happen, maybe even closer to an election in which one candidate has one type of way of talking about international terrorism and the other has another way of talking about it. I'm not sure how much it's going to come into detail over the course of the next couple weeks, but it does seem like this act does have at least the ability to get us talking once again about how we might handle the threats of international terrorism right here at home.
Sure. No question about that. I take Colin's point that Hillary spoke a little later and had a little more time to compose herself, although if you took their comments of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump after any crisis, regardless of the elapsed time, there'd be a distinction between them like the one you just played. And I thought back to Bill Clinton after the Oklahoma City bombing, during lighter other crises like the government shutdown, and the fact that, in fact, his entire comeback politically in 95 and 96, those two events really, really drove it. And it was a country that wanted to hear an adult voice, that appreciated the fact that there was a reasoned, calm, and collected adult at a time of a crisis. I guess I still think that's what we all want. I guess we don't want someone who's going to lose his own composure and dive into every fight at the slightest provocation in the time of crisis. But after the year we've been through, I'm no longer as sure.
But I think part of it, Colin, is just assessing the level of threat. One of the tweets that I responded to over the course of the last couple of days was someone who said, you know, in New York, the reaction basically is, well, there's a bombing in Manhattan. We'll go drink in Brooklyn tonight. The rest of America is looking at this and saying ISIS is coming to kill us all. And there really is a difference across America in what everyone might believe the level of threat to us is from Islamic extremism, as some people want to call it, from terrorism of any kind. I'm not necessarily sure that America, by and large, feels as though we're in a terrifying time. Many people who are voting for Donald Trump seem to believe so.
Right. And so, I mean, to Susan's point, the state of mind of the person hearing the words has probably a lot more impact than what the words are. Content becomes less and less important in these situations. The New York Times today, for example, is running a very rational story, like looking at how the policies of both candidates stack up against sort of what Rahami was or what any of this stuff was and whether or not they would significantly address this kind of a problem. I'm not really sure to these kind of hardened off constituencies that stuff like that is particularly meaningful. If in fact you perceive the threat as imminent, that actually works, at least statistically, if you believe polls, that works a little bit to Trump's benefit in that people tend to trust him on homeland security issues more and trust Clinton more on foreign policy issues. I mean, that's just sort of what they say in polls. Not surprisingly, she was Secretary of State. It kind of makes sense. Also, not surprisingly, in terms of their temperament, she is much more of a diplomat than he is. I mean, anybody's more of a diplomat than he is, but she is sort of diplomatic in her phrasing and thinking, and he seems, you know, like sort of Bernie Kerik times 10 or something. We're back to what Susan was saying, which is how you how you translate this into political action or anything else depends exactly on what your frame of mind was to begin with.
Yeah, a couple of things. One, I thought that Time story was very good. It was one of the first places in a mainstream article in which someone – in which the reporter – I forget whose piece it was – raised the issues of the broader culture and the economy and their effect on terrorism. And everyone seems not to want to make that connection that is to me and I think to any person who thinks about it long enough so clear. The second thing I want to say, I think is important here is that I'm still puzzled. I can't quite explain why the Obama administration has done such a poor job of explaining itself on almost anything that is remotely complex. It may be that people were concerned about the feelings of different demographics here in the country, but Obama's deported more questionable aliens than anybody. He's the all-time champ of deportation. Every president since Clinton has put enormously increased resources into border security with much better results than the average person knows. And it's part of the price we pay for a political debate in which we only exchange slogans and epithets and nothing ever really gets explained. If people really understood the quality of the work that's going on, if they really understood how much more intelligent a choice has been being made, especially, by the way, in all these questions – much greater focus on police than on military actions because that's the thing that matters the most in dealing with each incident, there'd be much less dissatisfaction. There's a strong case to be made, but it hasn't been.
Well, I think that there really isn't an appetite for complexity right now, and that's an understatement. I think there really isn't that appetite. Bill, you were saying that that people wanted to hear the adult in the room, and I kind of don't think that a lot of people, at least not Trump supporters, do, because that's what we've had.
I said they always had. I wondered if they still did.
I don't
actually
know. I think that's a good question. That I don't think that they do. I think that Trump supporters, especially, they don't want reason. They don't want to hear complexity. It's just sort of this lizard brain reaction to what's going on. And of course, this is all made worse by the fact that over the past 30 years and more, everything has been framed in terms of if X gets into office, apocalypse happens. That's been constant.
So slogans, epithets, as you say, Bill, also now internet memes. Donald Trump Jr. Compares Syrian refugees this week to Skittles, posting a message on Twitter Monday night that featured a bowl of Skittles saying, "If I had a bowl of Skittles and told you just three would kill you, would you take a handful? That's our Syrian refugee problem." Obviously, Colin, there's a number of problems with this. I think one of the leading problems is how little it regards so many other issues in America that do indeed actually pose a real threat to us. But that's just one piece of analysis. I guess I'm wondering what you make of Skittles and whether or not that matters at all this week.
You know, I struggle with this one. I mean, first of all, you know, there's a welter of questions here. You start with Donald Trump Jr. One of the big questions about him is which Corleone is he? Is he Michael or Fredo? A lot of times he seems more like Fredo, but he might be Michael. He might be sort of the guy who's, in fact, you know, in a very calculating way, putting out messages that once again mobilize a certain base. It seems to me that this base is now over-mobilized. I mean, the kind of chum that he's throwing in the water for this particular group of sharks, they're very well-fed sharks at this point. I'm not really sure he accomplished as much with this. This thing, meanwhile, kicked a whole bunch of tripwires. It's impossible to talk about Skittles without making people think about Trayvon Martin.
Yep.
It's impossible. And then this, the phrasing of this reminded people an awful lot of very specific kinds of rhetoric that was directed against Jews during the run-up in particular to the Holocaust. There was a lot of stuff like it only takes one mushroom to kill a whole village. And it's the same with Jews. So for people who are freaked out by xenophobia and by rampant prejudice. And then the other thing that's happened at the level of explanatory journalism, now we're back to like that Times article, a lot of different news outlets, Vox would be an example, you know, just did the math, you know, like how far off Donald Trump Jr. really was about this. And it's really like 10.4 billion Skittles or something. And they had all these infographics, including this size size of the bowl that would have to have all the Skittles in it. And then they had a little tiny thing that was actually Donald Trump Jr. compared to this bowl. And I mean, there's a lot of people trying to, once again, introduce. My feeling about this campaign right now is that its most likely first casualty is John Locke. You know, that the idea that we have any adherence left to empiricism may be the thing that is most at risk. But anyway, a lot of people tried to explain why not only was it dumb, but it wasn't even really true.
And then there's two things that bother me about this. First off, that's that Skittles thing, that's been going around for a while. That's a white nationalist meme. And it actually, the Skittles, there is actually a belief that they started using Skittles because of Trayvon Martin, because they were trying to make fun of and all this kind of awful, awful, awful stuff. And the fact that there have been plenty of connections between the Trump campaign and somehow white nationalist memes tend to appear with them. I don't know why that could possibly be. The other thing that bothers me here is that we get very scared about things that we don't necessarily have to be, like what Colin was saying. It would have to be a pretty darn big bowl of Skittles, not that we should be comparing people to Skittles. But also, there are so many other things that we're not talking about that kill us much, much more. Like, for example, we should be talking about guns, and we're not. We should be talking about car safety, and we're not.
Well, we know at least one person died because of the bridge backup caused by a political retaliation in New Jersey, a traffic jam that lasted for a couple days that's back in the news again this week. At least one poor woman didn't make it to the hospital in time. That's one more person potentially killed by New Jersey politicians than killed by Syrian refugees in America right now. Bill?
You know, I just want to go back for a second to two things that Susan said. And the first is, I get that this is the bizarro election of all time. And, you know, Hillary Clinton's greatest problem is that she, in effect, is the European Union and Donald Trump is Brexit. And I've been telling friends and saying in interviews now for many days, all the worst decisions I've ever made in my life I made when I was angry. And I'm worried about the decisions that an angry country can make. We're not immune to this. We're not immune. But I also want to just say, one, I think that the Democrats in particular have been too quick to concede to the reptilian mind and to try to play that game. And when we play Trump's game, we lose. People never choose progress with their reptilian minds. They choose progress with their higher faculties. And you do have to appeal to them to do that. The second thing you said I want to respond to, though, I just want to underscore my agreement, and that is, where are other issues? But I would add the fundamental issues that drove this campaign up until the convention. And one of the reasons this stuff is so big is that it's being held in a vacuum. The rest of the debate is simply the exchange of epithets between the candidates. And up until those two conventions in both parties, the rigged system was the central topic of the debate. And the fact that the corruption of the democracy was causing the slow death of the middle class was in some form the main theme of both the Trump and Sanders campaigns. I'll make a prediction. The first person who revives the pre-convention themes in the post-convention is going to be the person to win this election. I hope it's Hillary.
Well, unfortunately, Trump has already kind of revived it. He keeps talking about things that are already rigged against him. We see this all the time.
Yeah, he gets when the system's rigged against him, and usually in ways that it isn't. Barack Obama, by the way, yesterday, 7 years and 8 months into his presidency, gave the first speech that he's given, the first thing that I found in which he said that globalization may not be working. He called for a course correction. He didn't say much beyond that. But I hope that gives Secretary Clinton an intro here. You can't be the only major figure in American politics who doesn't see that global finance capitalism didn't pan out the way the people in the 90s said it would, and that the system is in crisis. I believe she learns more every day, but boy, she's got to get that message across to the middle class.
Yeah, we all learn more every day. Bill Curry's here along with Susan Bigelow and our own Colin McAdoo. When we come back, we're going to talk about threats and what they mean. Chris Murphy, U.S. Senator from Connecticut, wading in to those waters. And we're also going to talk a bit about polls and what they can tell us at this point in the election season. This is The Wheelhouse on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Joining us today is our Democratic political analyst, Bill Curry, Susan Bigelow, who's a contributing columnist at ctnewsjunkie.com, and also our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on this afternoon at 1 o'clock, Colin?
Well, not unlike this show, we're talking about the circus, except we're really talking about circuses. And sort of the notion that, I mean, circuses seem to be teetering on the verge of extinction. There's a lot of reasons why maybe nobody needs them anymore. But maybe we do need circuses. You know, I mean, I'm sure elephants will be glad when they're gone, but maybe not everybody else.
So we're talking, we're going to the circus this afternoon with Colin McEnroe at 1 o'clock. Donald Trump made another remark at a Miami rally toward opponent Hillary Clinton that some interpreted as a threat of violence, called for disarming bodyguards who protect his Democratic rival Hillary Clinton. Let's listen a little bit here.
Guns, 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 right? I think what we should do is she goes around with armed bodyguards like you have never seen before. I think that her bodyguards should drop all weapons. They should disarm, right? Right? I think they should disarm immediately. What do you think? Yes? Yes. Yeah. Take their guns away. She doesn't want guns. Take their, let's see what happens to her. Take their guns away. Okay?
So as we've already established on this program and over the course of the last year, those are things that we can all jump on right away. Chris Murphy, U.S. Senator from Connecticut, decided to jump on it on Twitter. He said, "Hey, real Donald Trump, if you keep suggesting your supporters kill Hillary Clinton, someone will listen. The blood will be on your hands." Your reaction, Colin, to what Trump said and also Chris Murphy's response?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, Trump, obviously, I mean, there's so many things wrong with what he said, including the notion that Hillary has bodyguards, you know, that like, it sounds like they're part of the Tonton Macoute or something like that. I mean, she has Secret Service protection. He has Secret Service protection.
Like nobody's seen.
Yeah.
I mean, huge guns, gigantic.
Right. They both have Secret Service protection. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the level of craziness. And, one of the questions that I keep exploring with people is this whole campaign sui generis, or are things like this going to be the way people campaign from now on? And nobody knows the answer to that question. This would feel like, I mean, this and all the other things kind of like it, you know, the Second Amendment people, maybe there's something they can do line. You know, this is sort of a territory we really haven't gone into. I mean, ironically, I mean, prior to this, ironically, the person who came closest to going into it might have been Hillary Clinton in 2008 when she didn't withdraw her candidacy. And she said, what if Barack Obama gets assassinated, or she invoked Bobby Kennedy or whatever. She's the only other candidate I can think of who ever brought up the idea of an opponent being assassinated as something, you know, that would be a talking point somehow. But she brought it up in a different way. I mean, this is just, you know, he's crossed a line that he has crossed before. He never pays a price for it, that I can see. And you just sort of wonder, are people going to campaign? And in terms of Murphy, I would just say this about Murphy. I feel like there's a little bit of, you know, I don't know what it is about Connecticut, because, you know, obviously Malloy's the guy they sent out on the ice when they want a real brawl. But Murphy's getting a little bit of that, too. I mean, everything was fine until the blood on your hands, you know.
Yeah, well, and that's we talked about this a little bit already, Susan. I mean, if the Trump campaign is going to have a campaign like this, and we're going to talk like this, and this is going to be the political discourse right now, there's a couple different ways in which Democrats can react. One is to wade in some ways into the same waters, and others just step back and go, there's nothing we can do about this. Let's just let, I mean, not addressing it, I'm sure, doesn't feel very good, but I think addressing it in the way Chris Murphy did with the line, blood will be on your hands, feels as though that also crosses a type of line that I'm not quite exactly sure where it is anymore in American politics.
It's the question about how do you deal with a troll? Do you ignore them? Do you try to out-troll them? Does that work? And I used to run a blog for many years, and there were many trolls, and ignoring them didn't make them go away. And trying to out-troll them didn't make them stop. It made them worse. The only thing you could do was block them. Of course, we cannot block Donald Trump unless we, you know, don't vote for him. But even then, he's still not going to go away. So It's an impossible question.
Well, I think you actually solved your whole problem. You don't have a blog anymore. And that's actually where a lot of these things go. I mean, we are seeing newspapers get rid of comment sections. We're seeing NPR doing it in part because you can't get rid of trolls in America anymore. The question is, how do you deal with them? I don't know if this is the way, but you can't really.
You don't have a blog anymore, which means Bruce Rubenstein has to find something else to do, which means he's on the audit commission in Hartford. I don't know.
Sorry.
Sorry. Bill?
It's like that butterfly that caused the big typhoon. Yeah,
we call that.
Who knows where this will end?
Yeah, that's right. You're an observant guy. The I said a minute ago that if for Hillary to win, she ought to be reviving the discussion of political reform and the survival of the economic middle class that Bernie Sanders drove during the primary discussion. Above all, though, she should get out of – everybody should do their best, consistent with what Susan just said, to get out of the exchange of epithets. We've seen this with Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio in the hands. It was the end of his campaign. Elizabeth Warren started out hurling tweet epithets at Trump. I'm glad she's pretty much stopped. It's getting into that same game, and I'll apply it to the Murphy question. When you're in that reptilian game with Donald Trump, you're probably losing, and it may be it couldn't be a harder time to appeal to people's higher selves maybe than right now. But I still think that's the ticket. And lastly, I just think what Colin said is also very important, that there's this question. What we have right now is trickle-down incivility. And it is just permeating the entire political discourse. Herbst, I mean, all this stuff, it's just sitting here.
Well, and that gets to our next story. Trump,
could I just say one last thing about this to Bill's point?
Sure.
I know I do everything in terms of movie analogies, but the movie analogy here, of course, is the movie Witness, when the punks from town are squirting ketchup and mustard all over the Amish people, and Harrison Ford eventually gets up, and the Amish people go, "No, it's not our way." And he goes, "It's my way." And he beats the crap out of the punks from town. And that's sort of Murphy. I mean, Murphy's Harrison Ford. And you know that's a mistake right there.
What I would say is that the problem here is that Hillary's actually been doing a lot of this stuff. She actually has been talking about college tuition and a lot of the issues that Bernie Sanders talked about, but she's not getting any coverage for it. Yeah. The problem seems to be that the cable news media especially and the sort of live-in-the-moment Mayfly Twitter media only cares about the really explosive stuff, and the bar for that just keeps getting set higher and higher and higher. So, yes, she could be civil, but no one's going to watch.
One, she has to do a lot more of it than she has been. But two, picking up on what Colin said, one of the biggest mistakes I think that Democrats in particular made over the last 20 years is to underestimate the American people. And it's the moment we decide that they are all thinking with their reptilian brains – is the moment we give up on the only kind of politics we've ever won with. And so there's this piece. Yeah, I get that people have never looked more threatening than they do right now. But this is still a country made up of people who are, by and large, good-hearted, open-minded. And Hillary's problem is not that she sounds like an adult. That's a strength. Her problems are the ones that I've talked about. And if she corrects those, being an adult will help.
I just want to quickly get to this point of trickle-down incivility. Trumbull Republican First Selectman Tim Herbst says he mistakenly sent a text to his colleague, Democrat David Alexander, a former friendly political rival. Now Alexander is the legislator in Enfield. Herbst is working with the state GOP to take control of the legislature. The text was a scene from the 1983 movie Sudden Impact. Let's listen to a little bit of audio. This is Alexander talking to the Hartford Current.
Selectman Herbst would send me that type of text message, especially in this day and age. Gun violence is not a laughing matter. And as somebody that was an officer, a company grade officer in the Marine Corps, that learned how to deploy crew-served weapons, that's not a joking matter where I come from, personally.
Okay, so you already invoked a movie, Colin, where an action figure character, you know, says, "That's my way." Well, this text said, "Go ahead, make my day."
Right. So, first of all, this was not a mistake on Tim Herbst's part. Yeah. I
what
will...
a dodgy explanation.
Yeah. No, that's not
I sent this to the wrong enemy or something? What was that?
You know,
that was ridiculous.
This was not a mistake. And it's very much in character with Tim Herbst. I mean, this is a guy, guy who's in some ways a rising politician in the Republican Party. It was really he who deposed Jerry Labriola as chairman and put J.R. Romano, his guy, in as chairman. Ran a semi-interesting or you know, closer to successful than people might have expected campaign against Denise Napier for state treasurer. But he's combative. I mean, look, when Bill Finch complains that you're brusque and combative, you know, when you stand out as brusque and combative among Bridgeport politicians, you know, that says something. I mean, in general, in Trumbull, he's viewed as a lightning rod, as a divisive guy, a guy who keeps enemies lists. He's only about 35 years old, and he's already sort of turned into, you know, Dick Nixon at 60 or something. So, I mean, if in fact reptilian politics are the new vogue, and if Trumpism in fact is something that will be carried forward after all this, then the future is really bright for Tim Hurst, because this is not an isolated incident. It's a part of a pattern.
Yeah, and I agree with Colin there. It seems like the only way to get ahead in politics now is to be a bruiser. But this is also part of a larger story about Representative Alexander and his troubles, and because Tim Herbst, during the response to all of this, actually brought up Alexander's DUI problems. And also Herbst runs this thing called TimPAC, which is trying to defeat various Democrats who they feel are vulnerable. Alexander is one of them. Whether or not he's actually vulnerable, I don't know. The 58th district has been Democratic since forever. But this is the I think the context in which this is all happening is that somebody who is vulnerable is feeling threatened.
But first of all, what Herbst did was deplorable. But what this reminds me of, if I can just shift a second, and that is to the question of whether we're ready to open the betting window on whether or not even these flawed Republicans, looking for movie analogies at my level, the bad news bears. These guys are really not much to look at. And yet there's still a chance, given the extraordinary dissatisfaction with the state government, I think there's still a chance that they could actually close the gap in the Senate and come close in the House. And this stuff is a little bit more, I think, up for grabs than most people think.
Well, you follow this stuff very closely, Susan.
Well, I think that this year, no. And the reason why is Donald Trump. I think that that's actually going to bump turnout up enough in places where Democrats need it to save a couple of seats. I really do think that. But I do
in
think
– swing seats? You think that the anti-Trump vote in the swing seats will be strong enough?
I think it might be. I think that people in Connecticut
I would agree on statewide offices. Well, looking at that list of endangered species.
Well, it's in a place like Enfield, though. Let's talk about that seat.
Yeah, that's where
I think that you have a constituency there that's very moderate for the most part, that tends to favor moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans. That's what people in Enfield, that's what we vote for. And there's a lot of dislike of Trump there, and there's a lot of dislike of where that brand of Republicanism is going. So I think, yeah, you're going to see some turnout there. If this was, let's say, 2018, then I think you would see the swing. And I think that we're going to see the swing in 2018. If we don't see it this year, I think it's going to be close. But I think we will see it then.
I'm so ready to glom on to anything I hear that's reassuring that I will just take that and go with it.
I just want to quickly turn before we have to take a break to something that it almost feels like it's a parallel conversation that's happening while a whole bunch of other things are happening in America. So throughout the course of this program, we've talked a lot about what people say and tweet and threaten and talk. And that's what we seem to be covering in America. What actually seems to be happening in parts of America is something that has been happening for the last several years, time and time again. We've had two police shootings of black men, one in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Terrence Crutcher, one in Charlotte, North Carolina, Keith Lamont Scott. Overnight in Charlotte, North Carolina, protests turned violent. There are an awful lot of people calling for this to be, once again, a very important issue in American politics. Colin, as we head into the debate on Monday between these two candidates, do you think there's any chance, with all these other things that are happening in the world, that we actually have questions about Black Lives Matter, about whether or not there needs to be a holistic review or look at how police do their jobs in African-American communities and urban areas across the country?
I'm guessing Lester Holt does ask that question somehow, somehow or other it comes up. And the other thing that I would say is, and not to – I mean, once again, I feel bad making things like this political, because right now they need to be what they are. And we need to get answers. We're a little ahead of the curve right now in terms of our complete understanding of each one of these incidents. Of course, the North Carolina situation, we really want to know which version of it is true. All those things are incredibly important. Let's park that for a second. One thing that I will say is I do expect that sometime in the next 48 days, if that's what's left, you'll see Barack Obama go to North Carolina and say, you know, these are two candidates with starkly different approaches to this problem. You know, you have to bear that in mind. And he's been giving some speeches lately. You know, he did the whole thing about I would be personally insulted if you didn't vote. He in particular is trying to mobilize black constituencies because of some of these issues.
Yeah. And I guess I'll just get back to something that I've said on this program before. And it has frustrated many people about Barack Obama, Susan, the president, is perhaps he will go to North Carolina and he will try to get people engaged in this issue because there is an election at stake. Many in the black community in Ferguson, Missouri, felt he took far too long to address that issue. Many people in Baltimore felt he took far too long to address the issue that was happening at a community that is about a 45-minute drive. And if you've got a presidential motorcade, it's really only about 35 minutes between one city and the other. To bring this again back to politics, if this becomes a political issue, it's one thing. Maybe this is something the president of the United States has needed to take more seriously over the course of the last several years. As black members of the American population say, please listen to us about this.
Yeah, and there's this – I feel like Barack Obama probably feels like he's kind of trapped on this because whenever he does try to address it, the blowback is just fierce. That he usually – even if he says something extremely mild, like I could have had a son that would look like Trayvon Martin, just the blowback from that was incredible. And I think he understands the sort of delicate position that he's in. But that said, yeah, I would have liked to see that. I know a lot of people in the black community would have loved to see him take a much stronger stand on this. I do think that this is something that really does need to be central. If you watch the video, which is horrifying, from the Tulsa shooting, it's heartbreaking and outrageous what's going on. And this broken trust between the black community and the police and this is going to cause us a lot of grief and a lot of heartache, especially among members of the black community who feel like they are completely under threat. This also does feed into our national culture of paranoia and fear and suspicion where we are all scared of one another.
You know, I what I'm most struck with in political terms, and again, like Colin, it's hard to just talk about it in that way, but this debate has gone south in many senses. When this horrible series of videos of police shooting unarmed blacks began, the country very quickly came to a consensus, two-thirds and more in favor of civilian review, one of the most controversial questions about police, two-thirds or more in favor of body cameras. 80% or more in favor of more training and sensitivity and cultural training and stuff. And since then, in part because the police are a patriotic symbol in political debate, the right has used even all calls for reform, even the most moderate, in a way to divide people, and they've done it very successfully. The Police Benevolent Association this week endorsed Donald Trump, a man who has argued for more law-breaking, illegal instructions and actions by government in the course of his campaign, than anybody I can remember in history. It's a tough moment, but we have to find a better way of talking to the affected constituencies about these issues because they showed early on they were ready to come around.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to find out what we can see in the polls right now. We're only, as Colin said, 48 days out. So what are they telling us? We seem to see Hillary Clinton dropping in the polls. We'll talk about that and also get some final thoughts this hour on The Wheelhouse on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on Next, we'll be looking at economic opportunities growing in some mill towns like Lawrence and Fitchburg, Massachusetts, as part of an NPR series, A Nation Engaged, looking at economic opportunities heading into the election year. We're also going to be remembering a faded New England icon. The last New England Howard Johnson's closed. this month up in Maine. We're going to take a look back at the history.
Try to hold it together, John.
We're going to look back at the history.
I know how deeply affected you are
here. The history of hojos.
Just breathe.
That's okay. Tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock on Next. Today in the program, we're talking about the news of the week with Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com, Bill Curry, our Democratic political analyst, and Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, who also moonlights Trinity College, taking a look at all things having to do with media, polling, politics in this election year. What are you seeing in the polls right now, Colin, as we see Hillary Clinton, after this controversy about her health, dropping in the polls? We knew it would tighten up, but what do you see here?
So my wonderful glass of Trinity and I spent last night going over all this stuff, and we wound up probably more confused than when we began. We live in an age where there's a tremendous amount of polling data available and a tremendous number of platforms that crunch it for you in different ways. And in some ways, that can introduce clarity. In other ways, it can make you really confusing. I spend a lot of time with all this stuff so that you don't have to. This is how I would boil it down very quickly.
No,
I mean,
there's love it.
Yeah, there's two possibilities. There's really two possibilities. This is going to end on a note of agnosticism. I'm warning you in advance. But so there's two possibilities. One of them is what's called regression to the mean, which means basically that, you know, there's a lot of wobble. There's a lot of noise, there, you know, in an election like this one. But that ultimately there is some kind of mean that the numbers will keep going back to at a certain point. So, and this is true in most elections. I mean, it looked like, for example, after the first debate in 2012 that Romney had really hurt Obama. Obama had a very bad performance. But if you look at that in terms of the trend line overall, there was ultimately kind of a regression back to the mean. So that's what's going to happen, unless it doesn't. And the reason that it might not in this situation is, you know, there are ways in which this doesn't resemble other data sets. These are two candidates with historically high unfavorable ratings. We've never really seen anything quite like that. I believe the numbers of people who say they are essentially voting against the other candidate are also historically high. So it's a little bit hard to rate those things. The one thing that I would say, this is not exactly polling, but I'll just throw it out there because it might be the data analytics game changer or something that will make this election very different. Slate is going to do something very unusual on Election Day this year, which is to provide real-time data analysis on Election Day, not using exit polls, but using some of the data models, which I won't bore you with, that political professionals use to see how their election's going. And this means in some of the early states, the early voting states, where a high percentage of people, like a place like North Carolina, they could tell us at dawn that day that how at least in their opinion, North Carolina went. So there's going to be real-time swing state information out there, which everybody who is interested in this kind of thing is going to be reading. It is kind of a paradigm shift, and I'll be intrigued. It's either going to be regarded as one of the biggest disasters and blunders by a media organization, or it will just change the way election days are reported from now on.
Change the way election days are reported, but does it substantively change the way election days are run? I mean, if you see in real time that a North Carolina is going one way or the other, I mean, does it change the ground game operation in said state?
Well, the model is, you know, the old model is 1980, where NBC called the election for Reagan before West Coast voting was completed. There was kind of a sense that maybe for down ballot races in West Coast states, particularly California, that might have meant that people stopped voting because the whole thing was over. Carter also conceded because in his internal numbers plus NBC's call, he conceded before the polls closed in California. The difference between 1980 and now is that there's just constant communication between campaigns and voters. I mean, how many emails are you going to get today from each side telling you, and often using the most catastrophic numbers about their candidate, right? That's the email that you get these days. Look what the polls just – look what Nate Silver just said. We're screwed. You got to give us more money. And you'll see that on Election Day, that if Slate starts, you know, in Ohio saying, wow, look at the Denison county precincts here, blah, blah, blah. You know, the campaigns will use that as a way to drive turnout and declare an emergency where they need help. So, you know, it's really different from 1980. I mean, that you can say anyway. It's not so much of a top-down information flow.
Polling itself is also in trouble. It's not as useful, I think, as it used to be. And we take a look at the United Kingdom for this. Their last two major national things in the United Kingdom were badly mispolled. And there's a lot of reasons why. A lot of polling firms use either online polls, which connect with a certain group, or landline polls, which, you know, how many people still have a landline? And there's all these problems with polling and the way polling is done that connects with the modern world in kind of a bad way that so far so good. We haven't had a disaster like that in the United States where, you know, for the Brexit referendum, the polls actually said, oh, no, Leave will probably win, it'll be okay. And the actual result was very different. We may see something like that here. I don't know. But the polls, they're only as good as the polling companies putting them out.
I mean, one of the things that came out after Brexit was the specter that there was a low enough information bar amongst voters that they didn't exactly understand perhaps what they're voting for. I mean, I would assume that most American voters who decide to vote understand what they're voting for when they're voting for the president of the United States.
Do they? I hope so. That would be nice to think. But, I mean, they think that they know, because I think that a lot of people tend to project onto the candidates their own hopes and dreams and feelings and policies and things that they want. So, yeah, I mean, you could be voting for Donald Trump, but really you might just be voting against Hillary Clinton, like what Colin said here.
I think it was Shakespeare who said, first we kill all the pollsters. The one value I see in the media's obsession with polling is that it may be a way of teaching STEM skills to adults. But the price we pay is, if you will, the crowding out of intellectual capital. The amount of time this stuff takes up in the media, the amount of tension it gets, there's only so much in that news budget, and it's just pushing out, constantly pushing out the stuff that really matters and contributing to the infantilization of the American people and to the diminishment of the debate. I can't imagine anyone reaching any other conclusion about this race is that it's virtually a jump ball on both sides. It's, you know, the only thing worth saying about it is this is close enough for anybody to win, and you better get out there and make sure that you're the one who makes a difference.
We have just a couple of minutes left in the program. We always like to end the show with some other things that we're thinking about, talking about, maybe that we haven't talked about in the news yet this week. What's on your mind this week, Susan?
Well, my favorite grocery store closed. This D&D Market on Franklin Avenue closed, and that's pretty sad. I was actually going to go there yesterday. And they still have a Wethersfield location, but it's kind of a sad thing because that's one of the last little pieces of Little Italy that was on Franklin Avenue.
Yep.
The other thing that's on my mind is I do have a new book out this week. If you are interested, it's called The Demon Girl Song. It is young adult, epic fantasy, if you like those kinds of things.
That's all I read.
I know you do.
It shows up in the interview,
yes.
Doesn't it?
So please go check that out if you want it.
Bill?
Speaking of Clint Eastwood, I am just going to say that I'm going to make it my business to go see Sully, and because it appears that you can spend 90 minutes with an authentic hero played by the actor who does the best job of playing authentic heroes, and in a year in which everybody's voting against somebody else, I'd like to slip into that for a few minutes.
Okay, so Bill's going to go take a look at Sully. How about you, Colin?
Three very quick things, two just sort of factoids. When you were watching the election that involved Barack Obama and Sarah Palin and people like that, you didn't have a smartphone. It's a hard thing to imagine, but you did not have a smartphone. You did not get your information from a smartphone. I mean, if you did, you were part of a tiny little group. So just think about how much the political landscape has changed since 2008. You know, I mean, at that point, you know, fewer than 20% of Americans had smartphones. They were real boutique items. That's number one. Number two, I do have to say, I mean, this is like an overcovered thing, but David Ortiz is really doing an amazing thing in his final season. He is having the greatest final season of any baseball player in history, maybe the greatest final season of any athlete.
Of
former New Britain Rockcat David Ortiz.
Just about anybody, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it is just incredible, and he's having a lot of fun while he's doing it. He may, at the age of 40, hit 40 home runs and drive in 140 runs. This is just unthinkable. So, I mean, it really is kind of a fun thing to watch. The last thing is less fun to watch, and that is the GQ profile of Joe Scarborough. I encourage people to read it. It's like a Rosetta Stone for everything that's wrong with politics, media, human beings, and certainly Joe Scarborough most of all. But, of course, the big bombshell out of it is that he's working. He's seriously doing this. He's working on a musical about Donald Trump. And judging from the excerpts, he has absolutely even less talent for this than he does at some of the other things he does.
Well, I still want to see it, though, huh? Come on. You'll
no,
go.
I
yeah,
won't.
Come on. You'll
you
go.
Won't? Come on. I would definitely go see that.
Right, John and I will go. You guys can sit it up.
Hamilton already used the title, The World Turned Upside Down. So
yeah. I'll just watch the animated GIFs later.
Yeah. Let me just say, let's just hope it has a sad ending.
Let me just end on this. John Lender, the investigative reporter from the Hartford Current, wrote this week about a recent directive from Governor Daniel Malloy's top press officer, Devin Puglia. In mid mid-July, Puglia told about 25 executive branch agencies' public information officers to send a daily email to the governor's office that lists all questions they received from news reporters and what responses they gave them. Puglia called it a management innovation. Among the things in here, the PIO for the Department of Public Health said in an email to the governor's office about Bob Horton, a columnist for the Greenwich Time newspaper, who was asking questions about lead found in the soil outside a local middle school. Quote, he's definitely looking to bash us in this column. This guy is like the Jonathan Pelto of Greenwich. I love this, Colin. You actually doing this. The thing that really bugs me about this, neither you or I are mentioned in this article at all. They don't talk about us anymore.
Maura Downs is actually a really nice person. And she just happened to be Lender's main example of this very bizarre policy.
It's a very bizarre policy, but again, one that does not mention the wheelhouse, unfortunately. Thanks to Bill Curry. Thanks to Susan Bigelow from CTNewsJunkie.com. And thanks to Colin McEnroe, who's talking about the circus this afternoon at 1 o'clock. There's a change.
We have a Willenda. Actual Willenda is going to be on the show.
Oh, actual Willenda this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show. Thanks for joining us.